I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Yahoo Sports Hockey Podcast, Justin Cuthbert and Julian McKenzie. We are in the throes of the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. It really is the best time as we get into these really critical games down the stretch. Now, it's a Monday, which is different for us. Usually we talk on Sundays, but I guess we got to get used to being 24 hours later because Zone Time, which you host on Yahoo Sports, is one day later this week as well. So everything's been thrown out of whack a little bit here this week, but it's the playoffs. So we're just reading and reacting to news that goes beyond the playoffs with a couple crazy stories in the NHL today. One finished and another one developing. We'll get into Barry Trotz and Pierre McGuire a little bit later. But Julian, first, how are you?
I'm doing all right, man. Could you imagine the NHL draft lottery is what throws our shows out of whack? I'm half kidding. It's not completely the truth. Something else.
It's going to be big in your market for sure. There's other things going on as well. But, we're balancing quite a few things right now. So it's great. We don't. Monday, love to see you on a Monday. This is fantastic.
This is actually quite pleasant, just with all the normally we see each other on the Sunday. It's like calm and chill in the morning, could watch NFL football after, or maybe the Premier League game on the Monday. It's just kind of like in the hectic, like chaotic day, that especially on a day like today with all the news that has popped up, this is kind of like a, not like a cone of silence, but like a moment of serenity, familiar face in the weird tropical storm that is the NHL news cycle. So I appreciate seeing your face as we do this on Zoom.
You're right. It is kind of a low stress situation we have on Sundays because everyone pretty much puts down their weapons, puts down their cell phones. I guess cell phones are weapons in the hockey media world. Nothing really happens Sunday morning other than us talking about hockey, which is great. Today we're navigating a couple other things, some dismissals, rumored dismissals, lots of stuff going on, but it doesn't matter. We trudge forward. And if we're going to talk about round one of the Stanley Cup playoffs so far, we have to begin with the Leafs and Lightning. I'm sorry, Julian, I know you're a huge Wild and St. Louis Blues fan, and I'll let you inform me on that series moving forward here. But I think we got to start with the same old Leafs and the same old Lightning. In Sunday's game four, Tampa Bay Lightning do what they always do. They responded and kind of humiliated the Maple Leafs to even their series at two games apiece. It was a no-show for Toronto. It was a successful trip to Tampa, though, according to their head coach, Sheldon Keefe. What's your reaction to what happened on Sunday night between the Bolts and Buds?
I have a question. You're saying same old Leafs, same Lightning. I'm not even going to focus too hard on the fact that coming into the playoffs, you said these Leafs look different. And a lot of people were saying the Leafs look different. Let's say Toronto wins game four of that series and takes a 3-1 series lead back home on the Tampa Bay Lightning. Are we still saying the Leafs are different? What are we saying about the Leafs at that point? Are we really going to uphold? I'm sorry. I don't believe for a second that if the Leafs were up 3-1, and won game four, that everyone would just change this narrative and be like, "You see, I told you these Leafs are different. These Leafs are built for the playoffs and all these other positive superlatives." I know, having done a show with Omar as long as I have, and you partially as well, enough people would have been like, all right, y'all got to show me something beyond 3-1. There's a part of me that looks at the Leafs being tied 2-2 here as a good thing, because 3-1, we know how toxic that term is in the Toronto Maple Leafs community. And look, they could make it easy on themselves if they have the 3-1 series lead and win in game five. But look, we're not from stupid town here. We know how hard the Leafs make it on themselves. Oh, yeah. And well, yeah, you could say they made it hard on themselves with the way they came out in game four, but best of three now, an opportunity for them to go back home, at least win game five, make it 3-2, then they have to go back to Tampa. The realities are a little different. I don't know if I'm ready to say it's same old Leafs yet. They're just kind of in this weird middle ground where they haven't been able to take full momentum of this series. And the Lightning are showing that if you knock them down to the mat, they can get back up and battle back. They're a battle-tested Stanley Cup champion team. Of course, they're going to be in a situation like this. It would have been much more shocking if they had rolled over and died after like game three and four and lost in a sweep or something. This is a Toronto Maple Leafs team that at their best moments, they've really impressed. They just need to show it for games five, six, maybe seven if they need to. That's how I think of this Toronto Maple Leafs team. But the Tampa Bay Lightning, I mean, just they're really good. And if you're going to knock them down, they are going to get back up.
Okay, so maybe not same old Leafs, although I think there are some indications of that. But same old Lightning for sure, right? Okay, so 16-0 after a loss in the last three postseasons, basically impossible to back into a corner. You cannot put the Lightning in a position where they are down multiple games in the series. It is virtually impossible. So them responding is same old Lightning. Same old Leafs in the fact, however, that they've had opportunities to extend series leads, to pull ahead. Yes, they got up two games on the Montreal Canadiens, but they are now 1-8 in the Austin Matthews era when leading a series. That only victory came, I guess, in game four versus the Montreal Canadiens last year, right? So they've had their issues.
Wow.
They've had their issues, obviously, with trying to take advantage of an advantageous situation, being leading a series and having not a free roll, but the opportunity to bury an opponent. They simply can't do it. They are the opposite of the Tampa Bay Lightning in that regard. When they have an opportunity to do something, they can't do it. When the Lightning need to do something, they do, in fact, do it. But it is the path to, I think, that is kind of worrisome. Because, yes, the Leafs have missed those opportunities, as I mentioned, but it seems like Tampa's figuring this out more and more as we go along. And I mentioned that I thought it could be Leafs early, and I think it could be Lightning late. And really, the Leafs being up 2-1 provided that exact scenario where they had the opportunity to put this away, to go up 3-1, and I guess that's not putting it away because it's still the Leafs and it's still the Lightning. But going up 3-1 with a chance to win at home would have been a huge, huge thing for the Toronto Maple Leafs. But for some reason, they didn't have half as much as the intensity, not even half, a third, a fifth, a fraction of the intensity that Tampa brought into that game four, and it cost them. And I think the one thing that really stuck out, beyond William Nylander not wanting to go into the corner with Eric Chernak, and John Tavares continuing to do nothing at even strength, and Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner having nothing for the Braden Point, Anthony Cirelli line, was that sort of satisfied response from Sheldon Keefe about, hey, we did our job. We got the split. Now we have home ice advantage back. I think that was a terrible look. And I'm a fan of Sheldon Keefe's, but him being or trying to spin a belief that this was mission accomplished in Tampa Bay after blowing yet another chance to take control in a series, I couldn't believe my ears.
I mean, I think for this Toronto Maple Leafs team, they're clearly trying to go off any positive vibe right now. And let's be real. I think if you asked a lot of people before this series started, and maybe you don't talk too much about the context of each of these games, but I think if you talk to a lot of Leafs fans and maybe the Leafs themselves, if they had a 2-2 split after the first four games of the series against the defending champions, they would take that split. So I think they're kind of looking at it from that vantage point. But yeah, I think with the way that the Leafs have won these games, that they won in the series, they didn't just win. They flat out dominated the Tampa Bay Lightning and had people wondering if they were on their last legs. So I can totally understand there's some frustration there because they did have their opportunities to do it. But I'm looking at it from the other side in that a 2-2 split against Tampa Bay Lightning, there are worse situations the Leafs could have put themselves in. And again, they have home ice advantage for game five, and they have an opportunity to close it out in game six if they win game five. They just need to make sure they don't lose game five, because you're right, the Lightning are figuring it out as they're going along. And I'm looking a lot at those point totals from Matthews and Marner. I mean, they got hot early. They looked really good in the games where they were supposed to look good. Mm-hmm. But if the Lightning shut them down in game five, it brings a bad omen for game six.
Yeah, win or lose, I think, for the Leafs in game five, I don't think they have a chance to win game six, honestly. Because I think as the Lightning have, as we've both mentioned here, figured out some things in the series, I think home ice, when they have it, benefits them to a huge, huge degree. Because we've seen in this series, you mentioned Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner, Anthony Cirelli and Braden Point have shut them down. Like it was another reminder this year, or it has been in these four games, that superb defensive play, i.e. what Phil Deneau did last year and what Braden Point and Anthony Cirelli can do, it shuts down great offense. And it doesn't help Austin Matthews that there's so many special teams minutes that takes him out of his 5-on-5 rhythm. But those two players, when tasked with the matchup of Matthews and Marner, are going to be able to shut them down. So where does that leave the rest of the matchups? Well, it leaves John Tavares to go up against the Steven Stamkos, Nikita Kucherov line. And I am taking Stamkos and Kucherov over John Tavares and William Nylander every day of the week right now. John Tavares has done absolutely nothing in this series. He is the second highest paid player in this series, and he looks like maybe the 15th best player in the series. He's been dreadful. William Nylander hasn't done much himself, and I wouldn't be putting those two together on the same line again in this series. But they have no chance the way it's going right now in that matchup, which leads you to the third line. And I think Toronto's third line can outplay Tampa's third line, but how much is that going to be reflected in the scoreboard when David Kampf is what David Kampf is? A great player, a difference maker for the Leafs, but not a guy who can give you more than one goal in a game. If you're looking for more than a one goal edge in that third line, it's just not going to happen. And the fourth line, we know Toronto's fourth line has been ineffective. And when they have it going, Tampa's line can be a needle mover. So the Leafs can't really pick up matchups other than special teams action to take advantage of in Tampa, but they can control the matchups in game five and in game seven. So it looks to me like they have to win those too. What are you seeing from John Tavares? Because this is a guy that people like to handle with kid gloves a little bit in this market. For some reason, yeah, he doesn't get the blame that others do. Listening to radio and the online commentary, Tavares is getting a lot, but Matthews is getting just as much, and Nylander is getting shelled as well. Like, it really is on the second line to do its job, and it hasn't. I think John Tavares just sticks out so much for me right now as really the difference in the series and why Toronto hasn't been able to take advantage of what's been poor Andrei Vasilevsky play and games that were up for grabs so far.
Is it like an age thing? Is it a wear and tear thing? Is it a performance thing with John Tavares? I've seen other colleagues say that he just looks slow out there.
Yeah,
it has to be. Because look, for a series like this against Tampa Bay, look, we know a guy like Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner, they're going to be looked at as top line performers, and the Leafs are going to rely on them to perform, but they need their secondary guys to step up. And that's where guys like Tavares and William Nylander will come in. If Tavares is not effective, then that's not really going to help the Leafs. I'm surprised you feel that not enough people are going hard at him. I feel like at different points throughout this year, just watching from a distance, I was just a bit surprised at how many people were going or coming at John Tavares because of the money that he was making and because of the production. And like, it really just kind of reinforces the fact that like, you can't just look at points and that a guy can get in the season and just kind of say that he had a successful year, because John Tavares, in spite of everything going on, was still close to being a point of game player for the Toronto Maple Leafs. A
lot of points on the best power play in the league in the regular season.
Yeah. But also, he's getting paid $11 million a year. And I think a lot of people, justifiably so, have higher expectations for a player making that much money. And if he's on the decline at that salary, that is going to prove to be a massive albatross for Kyle Dubas to deal with in the future. And the fact that he's not really playing up to stuff in the playoffs, that's going to be a problem for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Again, a team that you know, if as the Lightning figure the Leafs out, and if they shut down Marner and Matthews even more, you have to point the finger at Tavares. You have to point the finger at Nylander. Everyone was saying last year, oh, well, the Leafs would have won that series if they had a healthy John Tavares. They have John Tavares now, and he's not proving to be effective. So yeah. I don't know what the issue is.
It's not a good look when the $11 million forward is the one that the opposition is trying to pick on, right? It's not good. It's not exactly, it's not hard line matchups. It's not like trying to catch him out there like you would with a fourth line. But John Cooper should have all the confidence in the world throwing Steven Stamkos and Nikita Kucherov out against that line because they are faster. They are more dangerous. They are, just so much more dynamic than what the John Tavares line can offer right now. And when I'm looking at what they have to do in game five, I think you have to split Nylander and Tavares again, because they haven't shown all year long, really, that they've had this really rock solid connection. And I think you need to ask of more from your third line just because of the matchup. So if you drop Nylander back down with Kampf, you have a defensively responsible line, but also one that can score goals, and Nylander can do his individual thing as an individual. And then you have to insulate Tavares as much as possible and make that $11 million center a defensive center with, maybe Mikheyev and Blackwell, maybe Mikheyev and Kasha, maybe Mikheyev and Engvall, if it gets to that point where you're just trying to make sure that you get a wash at even strength with John Tavares on the ice. If you get a better matchup with the top line, you can get some scoring maybe from Nylander in that third line, maybe you have that opportunity. But as it stands now, Tampa can wipe John Tavares away from this series and make him a non-factor. If you can shut down Matthews and Marner, you're going to beat the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Does it make sense to also flip Nylander and Tavares in this scenario, where you maybe put Nylander keep him on the second line and make that a primary scoring line? And then if you're on the theme of just trying to be more defensive, possibly if you just put Tavares on a third line, you get weaker matchups. That way you will have the benefit of having those opportunities to pick the matchups you want, having home ice for game five. But I think the way you've explained it might be a little better. I'm just wondering if that's also a possibility.
Yeah, I was actually wondering this exact same thing. Like, how could you sort of remove this from the equation? But I think the reality is that John Tavares is the second line, and John Cooper will treat it as such, right? The second line is the lesser dangerous of the two scoring lines, and therefore the line he'll want to get out to try and take advantage of. If it is comp, like he wants to get Kucherov and Stamkos away from comp, so he's just going to treat it, whether you rank them or how you like put the players around it, you're still going to be trying to avoid Kampf with your talent, and you're trying to strike with your talent against John Tavares. That's really the reality of the situation. And I think the only way to sort of get away from that dynamic where it's one thing or the other is keeping Nylander and Tavares split, because you can maybe get some scoring out of those Nylander minutes if they are indeed separate. It's a difficult, difficult situation the Leafs find themselves in, though. I mean, we're still, 3-4 years left of John Tavares? I guess this will be three after this one. So four more playoffs you would expect, including this one. I can't imagine it gets better, right? I can't imagine a scenario where he gains a step next year or is less likely to be picked on by a scoring unit. It's a difficult, difficult spot. And, we talk about consequences, what might come if the Leafs don't get past the Lightning. It's tough because it's the Lightning, they're the best team in the world, other than maybe Colorado. We'll talk about Colorado later. But something has to change, but the real problem can't be solved because John Tavares, the captain, the $11 million player, he's not going anywhere. So it's tough, dude.
Yeah, look, and it's not even just like, okay, we just kind of threw him in there, because we were already good and we just want to be like the Golden State Warriors and just flex our muscles and add Kevin Durant. John Tavares was supposed to be the piece that took the Leafs over the top. You signed him for this very reason. You gave him $11 million off the play that he's done and what he could still be. And if he's not going to get any better than this, I mean, yeah, of course the Leafs are going to be in a world of hurt with that. On top of the fact that if they don't win this playoff series, the expectations and the criticisms being thrown at them are also going to mount as well. Like, look, they cannot lose this series or else big changes are going to happen to that core. I don't see if the Leafs somehow lose this series, like either Sheldon Keefe or some big piece in that core has to go. If Kyle Dubas is saying, yo, we're running it back next year, I mean, I can understand that, you know what, they went up against the Tampa Bay Lightning, but they dominated them in some of those games, and there's still a chance they could lose. If they lose that series, like, yeah, you have to ask questions about how this roster is constructed and make moves based beyond that. It'd be different if the Leafs were just, I don't know, like if the series went a little differently, but the fact that they had those blowout wins early in the series against Tampa and failed to take advantage, to your point you brought up earlier, like if you're Kyle Dubas, you have to do something to that core, and maybe getting rid of Keefe is the easiest decision. But I don't know if that's something that might even do. And I get that people might be hearing this and just think, man, we're making all these leaps to the Leafs, possibly making changes, but the situation's a bit dire, I think. And I think the way the series has gone sort of reflects changes to come. Like stuff can't be the same for this team.
42 minutes at even strength in the series so far for John Tavares. 3 shots, 0.04 individual expected goals. His numbers actually improved from a 5-on-5 perspective, but he's still at a 44% Corsi, 0-2 in the goal differential. Not good numbers. Nope. For someone who is anchoring the line. That needs to be a difference for the Leafs. The other issue right now seems to be the defensive core. Mm-hmm. Sheldon Keefe has relied on Justin Hall for the last 2 games, taking Timothy Liljegren out of the lineup. What we saw from Liljegren and Giordano on the third pairing, once Giordano came aboard, very, very strong. But he seems to prefer the mistake-laden nature of Justin Hall over the maybe less than confidence-inspiring sort of performances that Timothy Liljegren can have. It cost them immediately in game 4. It's very, very strange to me why Justin Hall is preferred over Timothy Liljegren right now. And that led to one of the better sound bites we're going to hear of the entire postseason with a reporter, we'll name him Steve Simmons, asking Sheldon Keefe directly why his, quote, worst defenseman was starting on the road in a game like that when he knew, or they knew, it was going to be so loud. I'll just say this. I actually think it was a horribly framed question. You can't editorialize when you present your idea to a coach. However, it is a valid question. I don't understand why Justin Hall was on the ice in that big of a moment. Like, you know what's coming. The third line is coming to try and put pressure on the defense and try to make something happen right away. And you have in TJ Brody, the defenseman that settles everything down, available to you. And yet they go with Justin Hall and Mark Giordano to almost give Tampa every possibility to make something happen on the first shift. Obviously you can't hide him the entire game, but in that moment, it was very strange. And I think it was worth asking the question. Just should have done it differently, I guess.
I agree with that. Like, we don't have the experience that Steve Simmons has in these locker rooms, but we both know we wouldn't ask a question like that. There's a way to frame it. So I'm not going to say that Steve Simmons doesn't know what he's doing, but I definitely wonder if he meant to go as hard as he did, because he should know better than to just ask a question straight up like that. But I mean, hey, there's a soundbite and we're talking about it now. So maybe he got what he wanted. But the Justin Hall thing, from what I've seen, you know, just he's not been that great of a defensive for the Leafs, especially this year. I don't know why Sheldon Keefe would put him in a situation essentially to fail. And if the Leafs lose this series, I feel like you're going to have to go back to that coaching decision as an absolute head scratcher for this team. Again, if they lose, because they could still win a winning game 5. And this is how weird the series is. A winning game 5 changes the view and momentum completely. Oh, yeah. And just like, no one's been able to get a firm handle on momentum throughout this series. So one win will change that. But right now we're just focusing on Justin Hall and these mistakes. Like it's a bit of a weird one from Sheldon Keefe.
Yeah, it definitely is. I don't understand it. It's not like that's not the reason they lost. It obviously wasn't a great start. Things snowballed very, very quickly. I mean, it was 3-0 and the Leafs were shorthanded within 8 minutes and before the Leafs had really done anything worth its weight in positivity. Like they were awful. They didn't do anything right for 8 minutes. So I guess that's cherry picking a little bit to pick on Justin Hall. But I think it reflects larger issue, which is that the difference, I think, between these two teams, and as much as we just ragged on John Tavares, if he just goes out there and gives you a split at 5-on-5 against a top six line, you kind of have to just take it, because that's what Anthony Cirelli and Braden Point are trying to do. They're just trying to get a split against Austin Matthews. So split in the top six, maybe split in the third pair. And those fourth line, obviously Tampa's has been better, but like really you can see a scenario where it's kind of just a wash up front. But where it's not a wash is the defensive core. I mean, Morgan Rielly has looked awful at times in the series. Ilya Lyubushkin is having a really, really difficult time in transition and staying out of the penalty box. Brody, as I mentioned, is always really, really good for the Leafs. Jake Muzzin has maybe exceeded expectations. But that third pairing, whether it is Hall or Liljegren, it looks like a sore spot for this team. And when you look at Tampa's defensive core, you don't see those same things. You see difference makers. You see players that are pretty comfortable in the situation that they're in. The biggest difference could be the goaltending, but it hasn't played out that way. Both Campbell and Vasilevsky have struggled at times. Vasilevsky maybe uncharacteristically poor at some points in this series. But if everything else is a wash, it might just come down to the performance of the defensive core and really the depths of the defensive core. And Justin Hall starting, playing, everything sort of stands out as a real weak link in the overall structure of the Maple Leafs. And why that was underscored, accentuated, started by Sheldon Keefe, again, worth asking the question because it didn't make much sense.
There's no way he plays game five, right?
Considering I don't know. He seems to. And then where does pride come in? Because you were just questioned about this. Are you going to be like, yeah, he was right. He's my worst defenseman. I'm going to take him out. Or do you go the other way saying, no, he's going to be good for us in game five. So not that
it serves as a vote of confidence to Justin Hall, essentially.
Not that I think that question will make any difference in anyone's decision-making, but like, I just don't think Justin Hall should be playing.
I mean, he's shown already through that one game. He probably isn't the best idea to play him, but yeah, you're right. With the defensive core, with the way the Leafs look there, the Lightning, I think on paper already might have made a case to have had a better defenseman. I mean, they put in Zach Bogosian, who knows a thing or two about playing for the Leafs. And I think he hasn't looked that bad with the Lightning since he's gotten in. The Leafs have been it's a bit of a tough one with their defense, man, and the way Justin Hall is looked. They cannot have him. If they're going to have him back in the lineup, he can't play that badly again, but it's really tough for them for game five.
Yeah, that Leaf defensive core is not forcing Lightning forwards to making business decisions like William Nylander made, not going into the corner with Eric Cernak in that second period. Justifiably so, that's going to make its rounds. It's going to be talked about. It wasn't an overly taxing shift for William Nylander. And I don't ever want to like inject myself in anything, but I've been on hockey benches where it's not going well and someone just mails in something and the reaction is always the same. It's like, for God's sake, like really?
Yeah.
Really?
We try.
We're all going through the crap, or
like do something.
Yeah. It's I could see why the reaction from Eddie Ocheck was what it was. And Keith Jones, they did a really good job at picking up on that. It's not a good look. That's not winning playoff hockey, as much as it really didn't matter. And if he took a hit there, it wouldn't have changed anything about the game. But it's not a good look. And it's another example, one of many examples from that game. The Leafs weren't just ready to meet the standard that the Lightning were willing to put out there.
And again, if they win game five, we don't talk about it. We go back to the high emotion, back and forth. That's it. We go back to the high emotions of how good the Leafs look. We go back to the high emotions of how the Lightning don't look as good as we thought they would. And the Leafs have what it takes to beat this team. That's just what's so weird about this series. And I know there are other ones sort of like it too, where one team hasn't completely grasped the momentum and run with it. But this series in particular, because of the focus and attention brought to both these two teams, it has just been notably weird.
I guess one pattern, though, or one maybe disturbing trend, if you're the Leafs, is like, okay, they get opportunities early in series, and then when it doesn't work, it all kind of slips away, right? So as much as it's been going back and forth, has it been that moment where they had that opportunity, they missed that opportunity, and then it just goes completely south? I mean, we've seen that before. We saw that last year where they just could not rebound from the missed opportunity that they had. Let's go to some of the other series, because we talked a lot about the Leafs and Lightning, justifiably so, as you mentioned. Lots of 2-2s. We got a bunch of 2-1s tonight. I think they're all 2-1 tonight. Other than, of course, Colorado and Nashville, which is over already. But a lot of 2-2s. Basically, the same night that the Leafs are playing, the Kings and Oilers have battled to 2-2. The Wild and Blues have battled to 2-2. And the Hurricanes and Boston Bruins, despite Carolina having a huge advantage early, is also 2-2. Of those 2-2s, Julian, is there one that stands out for you? And I think I might already know the answer.
So the easy one in this one would be to say the Wild Blues, because of the fact that I've hyped it up as much as I have. But you could say that's expected, because that series is supposed to go seven. It's supposed to be back and forth. Minnesota looking as if they're the better team. St. Louis and the goal scorers that they have eventually stepping up as well. It's cool also to see Jordan Binnington insert himself into this series.
Surprising to me.
And gets himself his first playoff win since that 2019 playoff run. But I don't think that's necessarily the answer, only because, again, it was expected for them to go there. I think if I have to pick between one that stands out the most, it's the Canes-Bruins series. We'll touch up on the Kings-Oilers in a moment here, because, you know, the Kings and the fact that they've evened up this series too, that is something that should not be taken lightly. But at least with the Kings and the Oilers and the Wild and the Blues and even the Leafs and the Lightning, they've been trading wins back and forth. The Canes had a 2-0 series lead, and we thought the Boston Bruins were going to be done and dusted, but they make a goalie change ahead of game three. And now all of a sudden they've tied this series. And the thing we're talking about the most is the beef between Tony DeAngelo and Brad Marchand as a major storyline in this series. Like, that's the one that I think stands out to me the most. The Bruins have woken up. They made some changes throughout the lineup, even though they've had to handle some injuries here and there. It's like, it's a bit of an interesting situation for the Boston Bruins. The fact that they've been able to tie it and they got their mojo back from those home games. And Carolina, like, I don't necessarily think they've played all that badly. It's just Boston has just kind of reared its ugly head and just kind of woken up in this series, I think. So the fact that they were able to switch a goalie and they've been getting some great performances from Jeremy Swayman, that has helped them in this series. That could also still go seven, though.
Yeah, I mean, game seven, maybe likely for all three of those series, maybe all four. Maybe that's where the Leafs and Lightning are headed as well. But if I had to bet one to get there, it would be Carolina and Boston. I mean, I just feel like it's the most, I don't even know if it's the most evenly matched, but I feel like these two are just, you know, on par and ready to just throw haymakers back and forth. You mentioned Marchand and Tony DeAngelo, basically like two magnets, like eventually they're going to find each other. And of course we saw that play out in real time. Tony DeAngelo is now public enemy number one in Boston, like he is maybe everywhere else as well. Like, that's just the Tony DeAngelo way. But this series is definitely building. And it feels like it's going to reach its crescendo in a game seven type of feel. I'm honestly a little surprised that Boston got back into it. I didn't come away particularly impressed from the first two games. And I thought at times it was there for the taking for Carolina to take that 3-1 series lead or maybe finish it in Boston. But of course they weren't able to do that. I am fascinated, though, by this Kings-Oilers series. I don't really know why. The Kings played outstanding in Game 4. I mean, I was so impressed by what they did after getting the doors blown off in Game 3 by Edmonton. I think they exploded for, what, 8 goals or maybe 7 goals. They were spectacular. They scored, I think, you know, they were scoring like 15-2 or something over the course of Games 2 and 3. I felt like that was over, but that Phil Deneau defensive responsibility, like, it just permeated the entire group. They really stepped up and played extremely well in that game. Jonathan Quick, you can never really trust, but he brought it back all the way to 2014, playing particularly well in front of that defensive structure. I feel like this is just two extremes, one really good defensive team, one brilliant offensive team, and they're just colliding into each other. It's been really fun to watch. I'm concerned that the Battle of Alberta, we might not get either party. It could be Dallas and LA in the second round, and that would be a tough watch. But I think this bodes pretty well for the Oilers that they're getting pushed the way they are, because this is a really difficult defensive challenge they're trying to get through. And it's turning into a really good series as well.
You know what else is also wild? So in each playoff series in the East, every team that has started off like on the road, like has either tied it or has put themselves in the position where they could win this series. Mm-hmm. So Boston down 2-0, they've clawed their way through. Pittsburgh has a series lead on the Rangers at 2-1. The Tampa Bay Lightning have tied the series. And the Washington Capitals, as we speak, have a series lead on the Florida Panthers. And if you want to take it out to the West, the Los Angeles Kings have tied their series, and the Dallas Stars have a lead. We're talking about six teams who have been to a Stanley Cup final, won a Stanley Cup, and have been successful over the last decade or so. And while some of those are upsets, if they end up holding on and winning those series, because they're clearly not some of those same teams. Remember what I was saying before about the Pittsburgh Penguins and how I don't really want to see them go far because I want to see a lot of newer teams go? Can you imagine if all six of those teams make it to the second round? And just as when we thought teams like Carolina and the Rangers were going to usher in the new era of all these really good new teams, it's a lot of the same usual suspects. We are in very interesting territory with all of those teams and how they've been able to battle back in each of their respective series. And we could be seeing, like, you know, some of the same teams we've seen dominate over the last decade kind of get back into it.
We'll talk about the seas parting for Tampa Bay in search of a three-peat. If they can get by the Leafs and Washington upsets Florida, Pittsburgh takes out New York, Boston and Carolina. I mean, I think Tampa would like their chances against either, but all of a sudden it's just Colorado on the other side. It obviously bodes well for Colorado as well. But if all those has-beens in some ways, and I say that with as much respect as I possibly can because that's not a necessarily endearing term, but if teams like Washington get past Florida, it's like just removing a hurdle from the equation. Obviously a great opportunity for whoever wins between Tampa and Toronto if it is indeed Washington that gets through in that matchup. I guess we can get to, I want to talk a little bit about Calgary and Florida because they're trailing. You sort of led us into that conversation. I think those are the two most surprising situations that are playing out right now. And obviously, as you mentioned, they have the chance to make it 2-2, and then we're looking at things completely differently. But I think Calgary and Florida have gotten this position in much different ways. Like Calgary's, you know, the Flames are getting outflamed right now by the Dallas Stars.
Yes.
And Florida, you know, they just run into a wall here in terms of Washington putting up that wall. Washington has never really shown to be a dominant defensive team, but they have prevented Florida from doing everything that they've normally done and done throughout the entire regular season. It's really quite striking what has happened to Florida through three games. And when you look at Calgary, we thought, okay, it's Calgary or Colorado this whole time. What that final night of the regular season, that comeback from the Arizona Coyotes, could mean for these playoffs, if Calgary just can't get by Dallas because Dallas is too much like Calgary, while Colorado gets to absolutely feast on Nashville in the first round. I mean, that is a huge, huge change and something that could just open the door for Colorado on the opposite side. But with Calgary and Florida, like, how do you think they've gotten to the position that they're in, where they're in like a must-win scenario in game four just to even up their series after coming in as such heavy favorites?
Yeah, I think the fact you outlined it well, just the defense, just for completely different reasons for each side. I mean, Florida, we've known them. We've talked about how dominant their forward core is. And we kind of gave them, I don't know if it was you, but some people have given them that label where they are able to score so many goals where they can even outscore their problems. That's a label that the Toronto Maple Leafs have had in the past, and they had to shore themselves up defensively. But we thought the Florida Panthers would have done enough to build themselves up defensively with Ben Chiarot being acquired and Robert Haig. Like they should be able to withstand, be able to hold up defensively. Just it hasn't necessarily happened yet. So I think the fact that the Capitals probably just recognized that they were in a series where they had to shut down defensively, especially with the goaltending that they had, Vitek Vanacek and Ilya Samsonov, like those were not supposed to be world beaters in this series. They almost kind of had no choice but to do that. So the Flames and the Stars, yeah, the Stars are a bit of a similar situation to being a defensive grinding team. That's what's gotten them into the position that they're in right now. And that really was going to be the best way that they were going to be able to give themselves a chance against this this Calgary Flames team, which can be defensive, but they have the goal scorers that they have. And that's it. The Dallas Stars have played this way before. They have an idea of how to go up against a team like Calgary because they are that team in a way. So I think defense has proven to be the biggest reasons why we're seeing Florida and Calgary behind. I don't know if it's going to stay that way, but definitely if both Florida and Calgary lose, we're talking two of the biggest upsets, if not two of the two biggest upsets of the playoffs so far, especially Florida being a President's Trophy team and then losing to Washington. Like that would be catastrophic.
It really is the theme to the entire playoffs so far. I mean, all the talk coming in was all these crazy offensive totals, individuals, teams putting up record numbers, but a commitment to team defense, like it always seems to be, has sort of won the day so far in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And it's been on a team like Washington to adapt, to force the issue, to force Florida to do things like, you know, have Mackenzie Weegar with no one back try to skate through that first line of defense and get picked off, and Ovi scoring on a breakaway. And like it's a rope-a-dope. Washington is sitting back and allowing Florida to just continuously run into the wall, and then they take advantage on the counter. With Calgary and Dallas, though, it's like maybe we should have been smarter than this, because they're kind of the poor man's version, Dallas, of Calgary, in that they do a lot of the same things. They just weren't able to run up the same sort of differential in terms of scoring. Like Calgary's scoring was more reliable through the year, but was it reliable against a team like Dallas throughout the course of the regular season? Maybe not. I mean, I would have to look back at the numbers, but this is not a prolific offensive group, especially against good team defenses. And if you can kind of maximize the variance in a series like we've seen with so little goals, if you're the one that can have Joe Pavelski having that deft tip in front of the net, that's the difference in the game more often than not, because there's so little happening between these two teams. It's really just come down to bounces. And when it's down to bounces, it's really just a coin flip of a series. Really, the only team that's been able to take their high-flying attack and win the day with it is the Colorado Avalanche, who are destroying Nashville. And that's just because Nashville has been sort of dealt a bad hand with not having their starting goaltender, being a little bit beaten up, and of course running into a team that's not just offensive. They do everything really, really well. So, you know, I'm a little worried for the next round with what's going on, because it's not exactly a goal scoring paradise that's winning the day. It could be a lot of defensive structure in round two going up against each other, which is not the most exciting thing. So it's on teams like Florida, teams like Calgary, to get back to their basics and win the ways that they're getting beaten right now.
Yeah. Just a note on that Colorado Nashville series. Like, I can't help but wonder if UC Saros is in net, how much of a difference he makes in that series. Consider how good he's been all year. I mean, I understand maybe not much, but like Nashville at least gets a win, and that might be enough to at least make it a little bit interesting. He might not be a Vezina candidate this year, depending on how you look at Shesterkin and Freddie Anderson this year. But also, like, I think UC Saros has been good enough where, you know, all he just needs to do is just kind of hold the fort, and that could easily swing a game the other way. Look, Connor Ingram was able to get a game to go to overtime, and Cale Makar won it, but Predators are a goal away from changing that series. Imagine if they had UC Saros in that.
It might be different, but Ingram basically gave them a Saros level performance in game two. And it wasn't enough. Colorado can sweep away the Nashville Predators, be the first team to advance with a win Monday night, is Monday when we're recording this. And then Dallas and Pittsburgh and Washington have the chance to take 3-1 commanding series leads later on Monday night. Let's move to a non-playoff team in the New York Islanders before we wrap things up here. Man. Firing head coach Barry Trotz, widely regarded as one of the best in the entire league, and a guy who took a team that clearly lacks talent on most nights in comparison to the opposition, to back-to-back conference finals, 5 postseason series victories, I think, in the last 3 years, after missing the playoffs the previous 2 seasons before he came aboard. He transformed, or helped transform, the New York Islanders into a Stanley Cup contender in his 4 seasons. And after missing the playoffs in a year where they started with a 13-game road trip didn't play a home game for 6 weeks, had COVID-19 ravaged them through the month of November when they were finally able to get back into their arena or back into the arena for the first time. This seems like a, at best, puzzling move on the behalf of Lou Lamoriello, who looks like he's laying all the blame for a season that had built-in excuses at the feet of one of the best coaches in the NHL.
I just want to read a quote that's been going around since this firing of Barry Trotz for Lou Lamoriello. I just want to put this out there. Shout out to Steven Wino from the AP for tweeting out from that press conference, by the way. Lou Lamoriello, did I consult with anyone on this decision? The answer is no. Did I speak to the players on this decision? No, I would never even consider thinking of anything like that. The decision is on the knowledge that I have of the experiences I've had and going forward, what I think and feel is best for this group to have success. What the hell are you talking about? And I get it. Lou Lamoriello, great exec, has the history, has the Stanley Cups. I understand. But to do this and not consider, you know, talking to the players about this, because I would love to know if it's one thing if the players were just like, you know what, man, Barry Trotz is not the guy. We need a new voice, even if they've had the success that they've had before. Then at the very least, you say, you know what? The locker room said this has to happen in order to get them to the next level. Fine. You'd have to do what you have to do. This just seems rather impulsive, you know, and especially the fact that this happens in the middle of the playoffs like this. There's so many things about this that just it's weird. And it just kind of reeks like the wrong thing, but maybe Lou ends up being right. But Barry Trotz's track record has shown otherwise. He had the Nashville Predators as relevant as they were under him. He goes to Washington and ends up turning the Capitals into a Stanley Cup champion. And for as long as he was with the Islanders up until this year, he had them as a competitive roster. He had them as a competitive team. They were a game seven away from going to the Stanley Cup final last year. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for that road trip to start off this year, maybe the Islanders are in the playoffs this year.
15th best record since the COVID Christmas for the Islanders. So he, you know, he was able to turn this season around in some ways for the Islanders.
So, yeah, I have to wonder if something happened behind the scenes, if Barry Trotz felt a way about certain things.
Yeah, I wonder too. I wonder too about that because this is twice where we've seen Barry Trotz's run end in strange ways. I mean, you mentioned the Stanley Cup with the Washington Capitals. It seemed like he was gone regardless of what happened in the playoffs. And then they went ahead and won the Stanley Cup. And it was like, okay, well, we got to bring the coach back, right? But we don't want to pay him like a Stanley Cup winning coach. So Barry Trotz cashed in on his success and went to the Islanders for a big ticket. But maybe because this has happened twice, maybe it is a pattern. Maybe Barry Trotz is in some ways a little bit difficult to work with. And maybe this is a power trip from Lou Lamoriello. But to suggest that the Islanders are better off today or moving forward than they were with Barry Trotz is just completely foolish, because this is a guy with one of the most proven track records in the NHL. Despite how his last two tenures ended, he is a superb coach and someone that the Philadelphia Flyers and Detroit Red Wings, who are looking for coaches, should have circled number one. Maybe don't Winnipeg even talk Jets. To anyone else. The Winnipeg Jets would be a good spot. Hell, I think the Seattle Kraken should be doing everything in their power to get him to Seattle, because if you want to settle the ship out on the seas in Seattle, who else but Barry Trotz, with a pretty talented defense corps, admittedly, that they have. I mean, he is 10 times the coach, I'd say, that Dave Hakstol is. I would be trying to do everything in my power if I have a vacancy right now to get Barry Trotz in there, because despite what talent discrepancy you're working against, Barry Trotz can make it up.
If you are Florida and you somehow lose that first round series to Washington, are you calling Barry Trotz?
Whew, that's an interesting question. Maybe as much as I just, you know, pumped his tires, we'll get to the tire pumps later. It's a different team, right? This Florida team is like based exclusively on one thing, which is attack minded style of play. And Barry Trotz, if there's anyone who is maybe behind the scenes poking Lou Lamoriello, it'd be Matt Barzal, because he kind of stunts creativity into a certain degree. So if I'm Florida, maybe I'm not dying to do that. But if it's the defensive aspect, if it's structure that fails them in the first round versus Washington, maybe you got to think about something like that. I'm not really sure. But if you're unsure about your head coach, you should be sure about Barry Trotz, because he can do a job for just about anyone.
That's what I'm thinking, man. I'm with you. Every team that has a coaching vacancy should be up on Barry Trotz. And it's my understanding that enough of them have started to reach out to Barry Trotz. And again, as I've been reiterating pretty much all day on all pretty much every podcast or whatever show you've been hearing me on today, because I've been on a lot of
busy
shows
day.
Today.
Busy day today.
Yeah. Very busy day. Barry Trotz was due to make $4 million from the New York Islanders next season. That brother's securing the bag from whoever he coaches or whoever he's coaching next season. If he that's what he wants to do, he out here getting this bag. You know what I'm saying? Yeah,
because he would probably have to be promised more in order to take a new job, because otherwise you're just leaving money on the table, correct? So
exactly.
It's going to cost something to get Barry Trotz. But again, you get what you pay for with Barry Trotz. So that's probably a good thing. Lesser distinguished hockey people, execs, staff members, whatever. Pierre Maguire would be considered one of them. Probably the opposite end of the spectrum compared to Barry Trotz, even though they do opposite things. But after 10 months with the Ottawa Senators, we believe, we haven't confirmed this either through The Athletic, Yahoo Sports, TSN, Sportsnet. I haven't really seen it anywhere confirmed. Just been reported, however, that Pierre Maguire is out as, I believe, the senior vice president of player development with the Ottawa Senators. Correct. Basically, yes. He was one half of the two Dorians, and now we just have, or the two Pierres, rather, and now we just have Pierre Dorion, at least it seems. Strange.
Just want a slight correction here. I can confirm that The Athletic has confirmed that Pierre Maguire is gone. So we have that.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So Pierre Maguire is out from his post with the Ottawa Senators. It was a very strange decision to begin with. It's a little stranger now that they didn't see the process through, but having two Pierres running the show seemed like a foolish idea. And it's an idea that has now been abandoned. Thoughts?
Here's what I want to know. What is Pierre Maguire's legacy as senior vice president of player development? It's not just Tyler Boucher. Is it Tyler Boucher? A lot of people like to get the Tyler Boucher draft pick and say, that's it.
Was that his decision? Do we know that?
That's it. I don't know.
I don't think he did anything.
I'm trying to ask.
I don't provide me with means. I don't think he did anything.
Genuinely, the one thing that I remember vividly that I could say, okay, Pierre Maguire did during his tenure was that damn photo of him in the box with Pierre Dorion giving each other fist bumps.
Yeah.
And we mean that, I think.
It's a great meme.
When that happened. It was a great meme. But I don't know what Pierre Maguire did. I don't know if he did anything. And that's the question I have. What legacy does he have in that position? What was it? What did he really do? I'm not trying to discredit what Pierre Maguire, what knowledge he has. I know a lot of people like to make fun of him with how he deals with analytics, but dude knows what daycares certain NHL players went to in their youth before they went to whatever boarding school they went to. The man is smart for a reason, but I don't know what this man did during July minus May here, not even a full year in that drop. I do not know what he did.
Yeah, I don't know either. So I don't know why he wasn't given the opportunity to continue on with this job, other than the fact that Eugene Melnyk's not around anymore. Obviously, Melnyk passed 2 months ago. Melnyk hired Pierre Maguire. Melnyk advocated, it seems, for Pierre Maguire. So I wonder if this is just, hey, this is not the direction we want to go anymore. We don't need two Pierres running the show. We just need Dorion to make the decisions. But again, I don't know who's making the decisions now that Melnyk isn't making the decisions. I know the franchise is stayed within the family so far, but I don't know why this decision was made, how it was made, the reason why he was brought on in the first place, the reason why he's now out. It never really made sense. I think we could try to erase this from our memories, but anything Pierre Maguire related is just far too funny to do that. So that meme will live on forever.
Yeah, but even then, I feel like we don't, I wish we would have had more time, because I really feel there was just so much more potential for us to really through.
It could have been a reality show. Edison.
Yeah, like a Sens TV thing where you're just seeing him and Pierre Dorion in an elevator, and they're just talking about, I would love like a 5-minute snippet of Pierre Dorion and Pierre Maguire. Oh, I funny I keep saying Dorian is Dorion, like he's French. I get it. Pierre Dorion and Pierre Maguire going. No, dude, look, I'm the guy in the French province here. I should know better. I would pay just to watch 5 minutes of those two guys talking about like either a player they want in the draft or what they think about a player and how they each, what philosophies each of them have. I would pay money just to hear how that discussion would go. Better yet, wouldn't surprise me if Pierre Maguire in the coming weeks, maybe not even the coming weeks, if I'm Mitch Melnick at TSN 690 in Montreal right now, who, for context, Pierre Maguire spent the last how many years as the guest at 5 p.m. on the Drive Home show on TSN 690. If I'm Mitch Melnick, the host of that show, I'm calling up Pierre and I'll be like, dude, what happened? And I'm listening to that interview, and I know he's telling us everything. He telling us what is going on. Because there ain't no reason why Pierre Maguire should be the situation that he is in now after less than a year on the job. Something happened.
Yeah, something definitely did happen. I think Maguire unintentionally on camera would be better than Melnick intentionally on camera. I feel like him breaking down draft prospects on the draft floor with just like, you know, someone shooting it with him not really realizing would produce, as you pointed out, some pretty great content. I think it would have been hilarious if we got to see more of Pierre Maguire. I actually would have liked to see him try to improve an NHL roster. Like, I wanted to see the Pierre Maguire experiment play out, but we're not going to get to see that. His mark won't be an indelible one on the Ottawa Senators.
You got to play. You got to play "I Will Remember You" by Sarah McLachlan at some point in this segment, just to kind of look back at the Pierre Maguire era that was.
I'm sure it's on loop in Ottawa right now. let's do the tire pumps before we get out of here. I'm seeing tweets. You got like radio spots to do soon here. So let's get you out of here on some tire pumps. I'm going to give my tire pump to the TNT panel. Now, we've been pretty effusive in our praise of the TNT panel. It's not perfect, but it's growing. It was good right out of the chute. It's something that is different, and we appreciate that. But I was watching the second intermission on Sunday night, so late night, LA and Edmonton, and they were just having a really basic discussion about like the difficult centerman that they played against in their careers, Tocchet, Carter, Gretzky. And Gretzky starts talking about Marc Messier, and somehow that conversation about defensive centers that all three of them played against turned into Wayne Gretzky explaining why they didn't wear helmets in practice, the Oilers, way back in the day, because they thought it was a good way to train themselves to keep sticks down, pucks down, and play with more responsibility. And it was something I'd never heard before, and we've heard Wayne Gretzky talk a lot, but just that's something insightful. So random that it started in one area and ended up in a completely random area. And it actually was something that like I'd never heard before, clearly learned and thought, wow, that's interesting. Like, that's not what we see generally with hockey analysis. We see, okay, 30 seconds on Mitch Marner, 45 seconds on John Tavares. Like, it's very scripted in that way. What I love about the TNT panel is that they let the conversation go where it's going to go and they have fun. So another example of why TNT is doing very, very well in their first season was just a harmless little bit that went in a very interesting way on Sunday night. So a tire pump, a continued tire pump to TNT.
Shout out to them, man. They're trying their absolute best to kind of replicate the success that's worked out for their NBA side and have it work for their NHL side. And seeing the different personalities that are there every time, got to shout out the Syracuse alum. That is Liam McHugh kind of reining everything in with that panel.
And he's sort of reinvented himself, which I was like, really, they're going with the NBC guy. But I've really, really liked what he's brought to the table as well. So good.
Yeah, he's been pretty lax. So yeah, well-deserved tire pump for him. Mine's a little bit more serious, but also a little bit warm-hearted, I guess. A couple of days ago, I retweeted a tweet from my Pittsburgh athletic colleague, Rob Rossi, who's been battling a functional neurological disorder for, I don't exactly remember the range of time, but this was somebody who was just going about their life, about a year, was just going about their life, and all of a sudden, their speech pattern was effectively just completely changed. Just a lot of stuttering, could barely go through full sentences, and they've done everything they can to battle back from that. And he put out a video just before the weekend, and that's the best he's sounded, at least that's what I've seen. He's tried his best to update colleagues internally just about how he's doing with the situation. He is back at work now. And he also just brought up the fact that, you know, we're in Mental Health Awareness Month, and mental health, we're at a position in our lives now where we talk about it very openly, or at least most people try to. I know there are initiatives out there where we try to entice people more and more to talk about them. But we're at a point now, I think, where we don't necessarily need to donate money to a charity in order to get people to go and talk about mental health. I think it's something we could just talk about openly on podcasts or with their friends, or it's just something that could just be part of that conversation. And I can't imagine what going through what Rob Rossi has gone through this last year. I can't imagine the toll it would have taken on his mental health. So to see that he's seemingly in good spirits, again, back at work, he's one of the better guys. I mean, everyone at The Athletic, I mean, not to pump tires for another publication that's not Yahoo Sports, but that is that is the home team for me. But I feel pretty blessed to be a part of at least that team specifically. And that goes for everyone I work with. But the team at The Athletic is really special and also just really knowledgeable. And even if I haven't met everyone personally, Rob Rossi has always stood out as a guy who is very knowledgeable about the team and very good at his job. So to see that he is back at it, and using his platform not only to let everyone know how he's doing, but to let everyone know it's okay to talk about mental health, I think that is worth a really big tire pump. So I'm going to show some praise to Rob Rossi.
A worthy tire pump. And I read Rossi on Crosby leading into the Stanley Cup playoffs. And that's just how it should be. He should be covering that team. And I'm glad he's still getting that chance too, and that everybody at The Athletic obviously is supporting him, and that he's getting better. Or you know, that's awesome. Awesome to see that he can get back to work and, you know, hopefully start living his life as much as he possibly can, like it was previously. We'll leave it there, buddy. We're in between the game fours. It's getting pretty serious. You and I will be back, I hope, next weekend, but again, the scheduling thing is fluid. So enjoy the games. Enjoy those radio hits that you got lined up. We will talk soon. We got zone time Wednesday night, so it'll be sooner than later. But things are getting exciting. And you and I and everybody else on the team, everybody at The Athletic, everybody in the hockey world is going to be covering this stuff as close as we possibly can. It's a fun time in the hockey world, and I can't wait to keep going.
After I did CJ show today, the Barry Trotz news popped, and I had to do an emergency add-on to that. After I guest co-hosted the Athletic Hockey Show with Ian Mendez, Ian broke the news to me that Pierre Maguire had been let go.
Anything break while we're gone?
That's what I'm trying. I'm looking at my Twitter right now, just wondering, did anything break? Because it's just considering how this day is gone, it wouldn't surprise me if some big news just pops up out of nowhere and we're late on that. I've just accepted that as my as how my Monday has gone.
I guess that's the danger of producing content on a Monday. It's usually we got some stuff that's trickling down throughout the day. But again, we live in a real-time world. We'll have coverage of everything as it comes down on our channels, on Yahoo Sports, on all your platforms, on my platforms. We'll cover everything off, and we'll continue to do that. Julian, appreciate you again, buddy, on a Monday. I like this.
Appreciate this too, man. Take care of yourself. I'll see you on Zone Time.
Cheers, bud.
Peace.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.